They have the House, the Senate, and the presidency, but Republicans still can't find a way to repeal Obamacare. We'll check the GOP's pulse on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The Republican Party's 7-year goal of ending Obamacare could be over. And it's hardly the Democrats' fault.
He can't get the Republican votes he needs. You know, the Democrats are standing on the sidelines. They're enjoying it as they stand over there and watch it. But the chances, obviously, for any big straight-out repeal are badly diminished, and the Republicans are sort of on the ropes.
Meanwhile, Alabama Republicans are in an all-out war to fill the Senate seat once held by Jeff Sessions.
There are 10 Republican candidates running in that race. Now, most of them are unknown and irrelevant because whoever wins a Republican primary statewide, especially for something like the United States Senator, it's tantamount to election.
And we go back 48 years, recalling Senator Ted Kennedy and the tragedy at Chappaquiddick.
I walked back to the cottage where the party was being held and requested the help of two friends and directed them to return immediately to the scene with me in order to undertake a new effort to dive down and locate Ms. Kopechne.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 188 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. It was a pretty dramatic weekend, both for Senator John McCain and the Senate Republicans, who were desperately trying to pass their health care bill. On Friday, McCain underwent surgery, known as a craniotomy, an opening of the skull to remove a 2-inch blood clot just above his left eye. While his office said he hoped to be back to work in a week, others familiar with the type of surgery, but not involved with McCain's, hinted that blood clots in that area can be quite serious. There was no shortage of Democrats who pointed out that McCain was getting the kind of medical care that would be denied or too expensive for many Americans to afford in the Republican health care plan. McCain's absence meant that Republicans didn't have the votes to bring up their health care bill, leading to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announcing they would delay the vote. Democrats also wondered if one of their own had surgery and was away recovering, would McConnell have still held up the vote? I think we know the answer to that one. Of course, McConnell never got the chance to delay the vote because he lost 2 other Republican votes before he could reschedule. We'll have more on the GOP's latest healthcare woes shortly. But back to John McCain. He's the subject of this week's trivia question. McCain served in the House, the Senate, and ran for president. Who was the most senior member of Congress who served in both chambers and sought the White House? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. There was no doubt in his mind or his words when Donald Trump said this last November 1st, just prior to the election.
I will ask Congress to convene a special session so we can repeal and replace. And it will be such an honor for me, for you, and for everybody in this country, because Obamacare has to be replaced. And we will do it, and we will do it very, very quickly. It is a catastrophe.
Mark my words, said Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, we'll have a health care bill on the floor of the Senate before the July 4th recess. Then we heard this.
We're going to continue the discussions within our conference on the differences that we have, that we're continuing to try to litigate. Consequently, we will not be on the bill this week, but we're still working toward getting at least 50 people in a comfortable place.
Then, on Saturday, after John McCain had to undergo surgery for a blood clot, McConnell said the Senate would, quote, defer consideration of the bill until the Arizona lawmaker returned. President Trump offered his best wishes.
We hope John McCain gets better very soon because we miss him. He's a crusty voice in Washington. Plus, we need his vote.
He may not be a hero, obviously, because heroes don't get captured, but with two Republicans, Susan Collins and Rand Paul, already saying they wouldn't vote to have the GOP health care plan proceed in the Senate, McCain's vote was critical. By Monday night, none of that mattered. Two more Republicans, Jerry Moran of Kansas and Mike Lee of Utah, said they would also vote no. And with that, the McConnell replacement plan for Obamacare seemed dead. But is it really? Does that wily Mitch McConnell have another trick up his sleeve? Or is the Republicans' long-stated goal of repeal and replace gone for good? For that, we turn to Carl Hulse, the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Carl, welcome, and what a week.
Who knew health care was so complicated, to quote someone?
That's exactly, to quote the President of the United States, right.
Yeah, that's actually a stunning sequence of developments if you listen to it all stacked up like that. As to the question, is it dead? Who knows? There will be a vote next week to try and get on the bill. Mitch McConnell was at the White House with almost all of the Republican senators getting a pep talk from President Trump. He reiterated he was going to have the vote win or lose, which is a big strategic consideration for him. So we'll see. But it's teetering very badly. There's a core of Republicans who would like to now move on to the Senate Education Health Committee headed by Lamar Alexander. He said he wants to start some hearings and to start doing a more traditional review of health care policy and work that way. Senator Alexander said that he didn't think there was 40 votes in the Republican conference for a straight-up repeal. I had heard that exact same number from another senator. I think that's within the Senate Republicans. That's kind of where they are. But this is going to play out for a while, Ken. You know, nothing is ever really dead in Washington, even after you lay it on the ground and chop it up a bit. Things can happen, but the chances, obviously, for any big straight-out repeal are badly diminished, and the Republicans are sort of on the ropes.
Well, I was just going to say that McConnell, first of all, was against a straight repeal. He always wanted to have a replacement in mind, but so he's still calling for that vote next week. He has to know he can't get 50 votes for that.
Right, and he's got all sorts of reasons for doing this, and, he wants to get everybody on record, but he also wants to show to conservatives, to President Trump, to the House. It's like, I don't have the votes here. This is it. This is something that happens in the Senate every once in a while. You need to prove you can't do something. And so he's going to have that vote anyway. You know, and they're taking some time. They're putting a lot of pressure on members. The fight's heating up on both sides a little bit. But it seems like next week's vote would be defeated, and they'll have to move on from there. And I do think that you'll hear more and more about Republicans like Rob Portman, Capito, the people who are against this thing. You know, let's try and work out a real solution using the committee process, talking to experts. You know, the way this was done in the leadership suite of Senator McConnell, it's left some of his colleagues pretty cold. And, you know, they're not rallying to his side on this.
Well, Trump's response on Tuesday was that it's the Democrats' fault and we need to elect more Republicans in 2018. Let's give a listen.
I think we're going to do very well, actually, in 18. I would be not surprised if something were done long before that. But in any event, because the margin is so small, the majority margin is so small, we're going to have to go out and get more Republicans elected in 18. And I'll be working very hard for that to happen. OK, and it would be nice to have Democrat support, but really they're obstructionists. They have no ideas. They have no thought process. All they want to do is obstruct government and obstruct, period. And in this case, think of it. So many good things. We didn't get one vote, and their plan has failed. And by the way, Obamacare isn't failing. It's failed. It's gone. So I think something's going to happen. We'll find out. Stay tuned.
You know what I love listening to that? I mean, obviously, there are so many Republicans, including Senator McCain, who've been talking about the way to get a health care bill passed is for Democrats and Republicans to sit down together. And here you have the president of the United States saying it's all the Democrats' failure. The Democrats own Obamacare. It's their problem. It's not my problem. It's not the Republicans' problem. How did you get away with that?
You know, it's interesting when you hear him talk about the Democrats, because you can completely reverse that, and that's how the Democrats used to talk about the Republicans. You know, you always change positions in Washington. I think, and he also called for the elimination of the filibuster, but as you know, this is a process that's working on a straight majority. He can't get the Republican votes he needs. You know, the Democrats are standing on the sidelines. They're enjoying it as they stand over there and watch it, but, you know, this is a problem within the Republican conference. So the thing that struck me about the president's comments there today was it sounded a lot like a campaign speech. It's what he's been saying for months. You know, we're going to have a great plan. We're going to do this and this and this. But the Senate is past that point now. You know, they've already made their judgment on the plan. They're looking for something new as to how we're going to improve what we're doing, how we're going to get to a solution. And I don't think he got there today.
But how? But when he says the Democrats own Obamacare, the Republicans own the Senate, the House, and the White House.
Well, I think what he's saying there is that, you know, this was a democratically created plan within the Congress, and it's theirs, and it's going to be their fault if it goes down. But I don't think that's going to be the case because, you know, the Republicans are in charge of the government now. What Republicans basically discovered in certain states, certainly states like West Virginia and Ohio, Nevada, is that Obamacare is working out for some people, and some of it's their voters, and many of them are in rural areas. So they don't want this program to collapse. And I think that if there is a collapse, which the administration would be part of by denying some money that's very complicated, but if the administration were part of it, if it happens on the Republican watch, people are going to hold them accountable. Any amount of saying this is the Democrats' fault is probably not going to get you off the hook there.
Yeah, you mentioned Ohio and West Virginia, and of course, Rob Portman and Shelley Moore Capito are critics of this. But neither one is up for re-election in 2018. Dean Heller of Nevada is, and as Dean Heller has said, and as Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval have said, that the Medicaid funding and the parts of the Obamacare are really working for people in Nevada. And so basically, I mean, you know, Keller has to go home to explain to his constituents why he would be voting for a bill that basically cuts these fundings.
And that his very popular governor is against. I think Dean Heller's in a tough spot, but he's not even that crucial to the outcome right now because there already aren't enough votes to pass it, no matter how he votes one way or the other. But he was seated at the lunch next to President Trump, who said, hey, you want to stay here, don't you? You know, so he was putting direct pressure on Dean Heller in front of his colleagues and on national TV. I don't know if that is a tactic that endears a senator to the president, but, you know, he's going to have a hard time with this no matter what, Dean Heller. He's either going to run afoul of the governor's wishes out there or the very activist conservative base that's in Nevada. So not a good situation for him, no matter what happens.
You know, earlier we heard Trump say that we need to have more Republicans in office, but at the same time, putting that pressure on Dean Heller, for a while, his allies in the Political Action Committee ran ads against Dean Heller that has since been removed. But now Politico is reporting that Jeff Flake, that the White House has been working behind the scenes against Jeff Flake of Arizona. So what kind of a message is that sent to Republicans in the Senate?
Yeah, I think that Senator McConnell and his advisors have told the White House to knock it off. Don't go after these incumbents. This is just ridiculous and is not helping you. There was a conference call, too, among a lot of the leading Tea Party conservative groups, Senate Conservatives Fund, some groups like that, and they were really attacking the Republicans who, you know, they think are waffling on health care, calling them traitor Republicans. And, you know, that's pretty strong language to use in the party against people. And I think, you know, you could get a backlash from that, too. That is some tough talk. And I also noted that, you know, they're also attacking Senator McConnell, which I think is really interesting. Here, Mitch McConnell last year really pushed the limits, if not totally exceeded them, in keeping a Supreme Court seat on ice and ending up getting a conservative appointed there. And I always thought that that might buy him some goodwill from these groups who have been after him in the past, but that's already gone. So they're after Senator McConnell.
Yeah, they have short memories, don't they?
Yeah, that was actually surprising to me.
Is there a left wing of the Democratic Party that's urging their senators not to cooperate with any Republicans?
Well, Chuck Schumer. I think Chuck Schumer is urging his members, and I think they have made a calculated decision here that they can't give the Republicans any room at all here for cooperation, and that's what's making it so hard for McConnell. He can't, you know, there's no Democratic vote. You know, maybe he would have thought starting out that he could get Senator Manchin or Senator Heidkamp, people who are in red states, to help them. But Trump's numbers in those states aren't even that great, and they aren't in the trouble maybe that they should be. But now what you are starting to see is with this, you know, sort of very quiet and halting and hesitant movement towards going back to the committee process, you're starting to see some of the more centrist Republicans and some of the more centrist Democrats starting to get together a little bit, talk about health care. Maybe we can kind of find some kind of bipartisan solution here. So you're seeing that. But right now, the Democrats, you know, have made a decision. We're not going to go into the room and cooperate. And they've really stuck to it.
You know, we always talk about the brilliancy, the savvy chess moves of McConnell. We're always warned, don't bet against him. But after this whole thing is said and done, and assuming that the repeal bill fails next week, how does he come out looking after all of this?
I mean, I think it's definitely taken a couple of nicks out of his reputation. I think that being the leader of the opposition is much easier than being the leader of the party that has to deliver. Mitch McConnell was very good as a opposition leader. This is a little harder for him. I think that, you know, there's some tarnish on the trophy, but he is still their guy, and he's, you know, he's doing what he thinks needs to be done, and he's exhausting his options. I've heard some griping, but I've also heard from some people that I thought might be critical of him. I've heard, you know, he's doing okay here. This is just, he was dealt a really bad hand, and we'll see what happens. But, you know, these kind of defeats, this is what people remember. And, you know, they remember some of the victories he had and some of the surprises he pulled off. But if he is beaten here and by his own party, then, you know, that definitely is going to be part of his reputation.
Well, you know, we saw this with John Boehner. We're seeing this with Speaker Ryan now, and we're certainly seeing it with McConnell. It's not easy to keep these Republicans in line, especially when they're in the power. As you say, they're no longer in the opposition party.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, there is a recognition by many of these Republican senators that this program is worthwhile in their states, especially with the opioid epidemic and the overdoses. And in rural parts, you know, rural hospitals really rely on Medicaid. Shelley Moore Capito, when she announced that she was not vote for the motion to proceed, she said, you know, my main pledge here is to do no harm to my state. And I'm not going to vote for this because I think it might harm my state. So some members, their first loyalty is to their voters there, and they're going to act on that even if there is some political repercussions here.
Carl Hulse is the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Carl, as always, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thanks, Ken. It's great talking to you.
It's over.
There's a special Senate election in Alabama on tap for this year for the seat once held by now Attorney General Jeff Sessions. When Sessions left to join the Trump administration, then Governor Robert Bentley selected Luther Strange, the state attorney general, to fill the seat in February. 2 months later, the 74-year-old Bentley was forced to resign as governor because of a sex scandal. The question is not whether the Republicans will hold on to the seat. Alabama is solidly red, and Donald Trump carried every county in the state last year. It's which Republican? Luther Strange, although he has the endorsement of the party establishment, especially in Washington, is being challenged by several candidates in the August 15th primary, including Congressman Mo Brooks, a Tea Party favorite, and Roy Moore, who was forced out as Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court. Here to give us the lowdown of the race is Steve Flowers, an Alabama political columnist and analyst. Steve, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad to have you, and it's a fascinating race, and I would think, or maybe you would think, that somebody would think that Luther Strange should be the overwhelming favorite in the race. He has most of the endorsements, certainly out of Washington. He has Mitch McConnell and the NRCC and the PACs in Washington, and he has most of the money. So I guess my first question is, what's the argument against him other than the fact that he was appointed by a tainted governor?
Well, first of all, you hit on that and another subject we ought to clear up with your listeners. And that is, you are exactly right. We are a totally red state, and this is an open seat for Jeff Sessions' seat here in Alabama. But there are 10 Republican candidates running in that race. Now, most of them are unknown and are irrelevant. And also, going back to your assessment, there are 8 Democrats running, and they are all irrelevant because whoever wins this Republican primary will be elected. We've used the word over the years in Alabama in bygone years. Whoever won the Democratic primary was tantamount to election.
Right.
But now, whoever wins the Republican primary statewide, especially for something like governor or United States senator, it's tantamount to election. So you're right in your assessment. Now, had Luther Strange not received the endorsement, as you mentioned earlier, he would probably be the front runner. Now, I say the word probably because we also have a unique situation in that we have what we call our Ten Commandments judge, Roy Moore, in this race. And the perception that Luther Strange received the endorsement of our tainted governor, who was left office in a very disgraceful way, appointed him. But it would look like collusion because Bentley was being investigated by Luther Strange, the Attorney General, and then Bentley, in turn, appoints Luther Strange to the U.S. Senate seat. Whether it looks like a quid pro quo act of collusion, whether it is or not, it looks like it. So, therefore, that taint is what's made Luther have some negatives. And the other thing in this race is that Roy Moore was removed from the bench again by some vague judicial inquiry commission from being Chief Justice. He was just elected Chief Justice of our Supreme Court in the state, and some judicial inquiry commission removes him from office for telling the probate judges they've got to disregard the law on gay marriage. And, you know, I got to tell you, that's a pretty good narrative here in Alabama to get removed from the Supreme Court for being against gay marriage. We're not in the mainstream of American thought on that issue or any issue having to deal with religion. We're a very religious state.
But isn't it great to have somebody like Roy Moore, who's been pushing for the Ten Commandments, to run against a guy, Luther Strange, who was appointed by a governor who left office because of a sex scandal?
I'd much rather have that narrative to say, you know, and the polling is indicating that. Moore is the front runner in this race. Luther is in a battle to get in the runoff with Mo Brooks. Mo Brooks has gotten some momentum in this race, and you couldn't ask for a better introduction to Alabama voters because he's only known in his congressional district. So the rest of the other 80% of the state had no idea who Mo Brooks was. But you get introduced as a conservative congressman who's riding your bicycle to practice baseball for the Republican team in the baseball game versus the Democrats at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you're so conservative that some left-wing wacko Bernie Sanders socialist is shooting at you, and you become somewhat of a martyr. Well, that's a pretty good introduction. I mean, you know, he got about $2 million of free publicity.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if I want to make the shooter a Bernie Sanders, versus the Republican story, but Mo Brooks did get national attention for being shot at when he was, or at least, you know, at that game when Congressman Steve Scalise was shot. But let me just say, for all we know about Congressman Brooks, who backed Ted Cruz, we also know he said this about Donald Trump in March of 2016.
I don't think you can trust Donald Trump with anything he says. Now, why do I say that? It's because of his track record. I was just asked a little while ago if I'm going to endorse Donald Trump after things unfold with Donald Trump having this so-called insurmountable lead. And I said, no, I'm not. And the person wanted to know why. And I said, well, look, Donald Trump is an adulterer. I don't support people who support adultery, and I don't trust people who are serial adulterers, as Donald Trump has been and bragged about in writing, because I don't think that's an honorable thing or trait in a person.
I mean, it's that
soundbite is coming back to bite Mo too. He got a bump off of that shooting, but Luther Strange pollsters, who are probably the best in the country, saw that, and they have now hit him continuously with that in negative ads. And my guess is that's thwarted Brooks's momentum. I think that because obviously from the polling, from the advertising, Trump must be immensely popular in Alabama. It must be that Alabama is the Trump capital of the world, because it looks to me like the pollsters and the media people are realizing, let's tie whoever we can to Trump. Luther and Mo.
Well, both Luther and Mo and Roy. I mean, Roy hasn't, I think in Roy Moore's commercials, he talked more about the Ten Commandments, but he did say that God sent Donald Trump to the White House. So I kind of like that too. But you're talking about the Luther Strange effort to remind voters of the Brooks comment. The Senate Leadership Fund is running this anti-Brooks commercial showing his photo alongside that of Elizabeth Warren and Nancy Pelosi.
Career Congressman Mo Brooks.
I don't think you can trust Donald Trump with anything he says.
They all attack Donald Trump, trying to stop him.
I don't think you can trust Donald Trump with anything he says.
Mo Brooks even refused to endorse Donald Trump for president.
A lot of people who have supported Donald Trump, they're going to regret having done so.
Mo Brooks attacked President Trump, siding with them, not Alabama conservatives.
You know, it's funny. Perhaps Alabama is one of the few states where the fact that anybody's saying anything critical about Donald Trump in a Republican Party can come back to bite them.
I don't know about other states, but it's obvious that Alabama is Trump country, because the ads are obviously trying to tie, everybody's trying to tie themselves to Trump in the state in this Senate race. Luther sat on the sidelines really during that presidential race. He wasn't anybody. Brooks was, in fact, adamantly opposed to Trump. He was for Ted Cruz. And was actually a delegate for him. Now, Moore wisely did not get involved in presidential politics. I think it's best not to get out there in other people's races. So Moore is, I think that he's a sleeping giant in this race. Without any money, without any advertising, it even Strange and Brooks in their internal polling and obviously in their game plan have relinquished the number one spot to Moore. I think that their game plan is to try to get in the runoff and then have 6 weeks to bombard Moore.
Well, I was going to say, obviously, both Strange and Brooks seem to be trying to outdo each other about being a Trump supporter. Let's listen to a Luther Strange commercial.
As our conservative senator, Big Luther is still fighting Washington liberals.
We're going to drain the swamp of Washington.
Working with President Trump to drain the swamp. Cutting spending. Reducing taxes to grow our economy with new jobs. Killing unfair trade deals with Mexico and China. Repeal Obamacare. Slashing funds to sanctuary cities. Using the funds to build a wall on the border. Deporting violent illegal immigrants hiding in the shadows. Ending funding of Planned Parenthood. Standing with President Trump to change Washington and make America great again.
And Mo Brooks is doing the same thing. Here's a Brooks commercial. Not talking about serial adultery, but supporting Trump's effort to build the wall.
President Trump promised a wall to keep us safe and to protect American jobs for American workers. But even some establishment Republicans are blocking the way. Elect me to the Senate, and I'll fight every spending bill that doesn't fund that wall. And if I have to filibuster on the Senate floor, I'll even read the King James Bible until the wall is funded. And you know what? Washington could benefit from that. We're going to build that wall, or you'll know the name of every Republican who surrenders to the Democrats to break my filibuster.
Steve, I was going to say, how much money is being spent in this race? It feels like it's a lot.
Well, it is, because at the beginning, the establishment super PACs created by the Republican Party, the Senate Majority Party leadership, the Mitch McConnell funds, made it clear to anybody who looked at that race, and they told Mo Brooks, anybody else, that the money was going to Luther Strange, that he was going to be treated as an incumbent, and they were going to really put the money to him, and they are. And I don't think you've seen half of it because, see, Ken, this is the only race in the country right now. They're stocking up for next year, but but the thing about it is that, you know, like you said earlier, they're spending money within a Republican primary. Whoever comes up there is going to be a Republican, you know, and going to be a conservative. I don't think any one of those three front runners would vote any differently on any of the issues. They all going to vote with Trump on the anything he does, and they're going to vote for the most conservative chief justice appointments. They're going to vote for right on abortion, immigration, any of the litmus test issues the Republican Party advocates. You're not going to see, if you put all three of them up there and gave them all a third of that seat, they all three going to be voting the same way. So it's not going to be a change in the national makeup of the Senate. Whoever comes in there is going to be a hardcore right-wing conservative, as anybody from Alabama would be. So it's not going to change the makeup of the philosophy of the Senate. I think what McConnell is afraid of is that somebody like Moe or Moore would be somewhat of a bomb thrower. For example, if Moore won the race, then I can picture them using Roy Moore as a caricature for advertising for the liberal California races. I think they're looking beyond the fact that we want Luther in that seat because he knows how to go along to get along, which is what they want in that seat, and who just vote and not try to be a show horse, whereas Mo Brooks and Roy Moore would do that. They would decide they want to be the picture of the right wing of the National Republican Party. So they would use, I know they'd use Moore, the same way Obama was used in Alabama.
I was going to say, the way the Republicans are using Nancy Pelosi now, you think the Democrats would be using Roy Moore should he win?
It'd be a perfect horse because everybody in California is for gay marriage and against the Ten Commandments and against God and everything else.
Well, wait. Well, I don't know if everybody in California are against God and the Ten Commandments.
I mean, that's a liberal area out there. They would use Roy Moore and say, look, this is what the Republican Party stands for.
Yeah, maybe they're against four of the commandments. I'm not sure if they're against all ten, but let me tell you. But anyway, you mentioned earlier that 10 Republicans are running in the August 15th primary, and the runoff will be September 26th. Now, the general election isn't until December, but it's pretty safe, as you said, that the winner of the September 26th runoff will be the next senator. And so, Steve Flowers, who will that be?
I can't call the final September 26th outcome because I don't know, but I think Moore and Strange are in a runoff. Moore's going to lead, and Strange has probably got enough money. He gets a place in the runoff, and that money keeps flowing in from Washington in the runoff, and they may be able to beat Moore in a runoff. My column this week, I say the choice is going to be whether you want a missionary or a visionary. George Wallace used to run against the Washington elite, and there's a real right-wing send-them-a-message type of thing. George Wallace ran with that send-them-a-message thing. You know, like we want to send those Californians a message that we still believe in God and the Ten Commandments, and we want to send somebody to Washington who's going to straighten Washington out like it used to be. You know, the country's gone to the left coast.
Well, all these conservatives say they're going to go to Washington and drain the swamp until they become part of the swamp.
Exactly. But now I'm going to say this about Moore. He won't become part of the swamp. He has no money. He raises no money. He's going up there to not just drain the swamp. He's coming up there to try to save the whole Senate. He'll be watching the bathroom, see if anybody comes out as a transgender or anybody comes to, you know, he'll be making sure they have a prayer and all of them have to have an attendance. You know, he'll have a vote on it.
This is the best race in the country by far.
Well, it's the only one. It's the only wide open, only Senate race in the country. You ain't seen nothing if you send Roy Moore up there. he'll have a resolution the first day that they all have to go come there for a prayer meeting every morning.
Steve Flowers is an Alabama political analyst whose weekly column, Inside the State House, is published in 66 newspapers across the state. He's also the author of Goats and Governors, Six Decades of Colorful Alabama Political Stories. Steve, thank you so much for being on the program.
Let's do it again. I look forward to it.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last Republican incumbent member of Congress who left the party and became an independent? The answer, Jim Jeffords. A longtime Vermont Republican official, state attorney general, House member, and then senator, Jeffords quit the GOP in 2001 and became an independent, though he caucused with the Democrats, which gave the Dems a brief time in the majority. And the randomly selected winner is Denise Vincent of Tracy, California. Denise wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest led off with a Sergeant Shriver for President button from 1976, then a Claude Pepper for President button from 1948. After that were buttons for Mike Sloan for Congress and Bill Lee for Governor. Another hard-to-read button had a lot of hearts on it. And that was followed by one that read, I belong to the Kennedy Club. And it ended with a 1980 Central Park concert button for the David Bromberg Band. So when you combine Sargent with Pepper and Sloan, Lee, Hearts, Club, Band, you kind of get... Well, we'll hear from the Beatles in a second. More important, the winner is Pat Lennington of Norman, Oklahoma. We'll have a new Scuttle Button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
With Sergeant Pepper's lonely hearts club band, we hope you will enjoy the show.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It was, for the most part, a very successful and rewarding career. However, on this day, 48 years ago this week, it was a horrific tragedy.
This last week has been an agonizing one for me and for the members of my family, and the grief we feel over the loss of a wonderful friend will remain with us the rest of our lives.
Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts was hosting a party on Chappaquiddick Island off Martha's Vineyard. It was a reunion of sorts of young women known as the Boiler Room Girls who had worked for his brother Robert's presidential campaign the year before. Kennedy offered to drive one of the women, Mary Jo Kopechne, back to her hotel in Edgartown. En route, Kennedy's car plunged off a bridge into a body of water. There has long been much speculation and rumor what happened, but this much we know. Kennedy escaped from the car, Kopechne did not. Trapped in the car, she drowned. Kennedy did not report the incident to the police until the next day, some 10 hours later. The incident, known in shorthand as Chappaquiddick, dogged Kennedy for the rest of his life, even as he was rising in the Senate. It played a role in his ouster as Democratic whip in 1971. It played a role in his decision not to seek the presidency in 1972. It certainly was widely discussed during his ill-fated bid for the presidency in 1980. Steve Kirkjian spent nearly 40 years as a reporter and editor with the Boston Globe, receiving two Pulitzer Prizes for local investigative specialized reporting, and was part of the Pulitzer-winning Spotlight team that broke open the clergy abuse scandal within the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Boston. But back in 1969, he was a Cub reporter for the Globe, and one of his early assignments was Chappaquiddick. Steve, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken. Great to be here.
So tell me, how did Steve Kirkjian begin covering this story?
Well, it was a weekend off, and I was at my family's summer home in Plymouth, and we didn't even have a phone down here, and of course, there's no cell phones or anything like that. And my neighbor, who's a resident, came to the back of the house and gave me a shout and said that a Globe editor was on the phone. And it was a gentleman named John Burke, who is a seasoned reporter and editor. And he told me about the accident. This was Sunday morning. I hadn't opened up my front page there, but there it was splayed across the front page because the accident happened Friday. It had been reported Saturday. So here it was now already in Sunday's paper. So he said to me, how fast will it take you to get to Chappaquiddick down to Martha's Vineyard? I told him about 20 minutes to get to Falmouth where the ferries were. And he said, there's a ticket reserved for you. Get on to get down there as soon as I can.
There was no autopsy performed, is that correct?
At the time, there was no autopsy, no. The family had wanted her body back to Wilkes-Barre, where she came from, and the senator's staff and office had facilitated to have the body brought back to there during the day Sunday.
Now, tell me the first, in those early days of your covering of this, the early days of the investigation, who did you speak to, what did you learn, and what can you tell me about the memories of what you went through?
Yeah, whom did I speak with? Try to speak with every person on the island who may have had some inkling of what had happened that night, and we certainly also tried to talk to the members of his friends and staff who were at the party that Friday night that preceded the accident. Suspicion quickly arose that there had been overdrinking and maybe that's what had caused the accident. But we were assured by those of us who were able to get interviews were assured by members of the party, and I think there were probably about 10 other people, four or five women, other women, and four or five other men, that there had not been overdrinking. There had been a modicum of alcohol, but there was not too much drinking. No one was drunk. No one was drunk at the party.
1 week after the accident, you were outside the courthouse where Kennedy pleaded guilty to leaving the scene of an accident. I can't imagine what that scene was like.
Yeah, you know, it was, for me, it was the first time that I had seen that whole week a sort of a media event surround this tragedy. And every day, the numbers of reporters, local and national and then international press, were showing up on the island and trying to talk to many of the same people that I was trying to talk to. Gets in the way of, you know, being able to get straight information. But it all came to a head that morning. I think the hearing was around 11 o'clock in the morning at the small district court, Edgartown District Court, on Martha's Vineyard, where the senator went in and pled guilty to, I think, the most serious charge was leaving the scene of an accident. He could have faced some sort of minimal jail sentence, but that wasn't to be. It wasn't necessary. The effect that this was having was on his political future and his political status.
That's a good point, because later that day, you know, Kennedy requested time on the TV networks to you know, as he said, speak to the people of Massachusetts. And so he had this 12-minute address to the cameras to recount what happened on the night of July 18th. And he addressed, you were talking earlier about the possibility of alcohol and some wrongdoing, alleged wrongdoing. He addressed what had already become widespread rumors.
There is no truth, no truth whatever, to the widely circulated suspicions of immoral conduct that have been leveled at my behavior and hers regarding that evening. There has never been a private relationship between us of any kind. I know of nothing in Mary Jo's conduct on that or any other occasion, and the same is true of the other girls at that party, that would lend any substance to such ugly speculation about their character. Nor was I driving under the influence of liquor.
Although, as you point out, Kennedy offered no excuses as for the long delay in reporting the incident to the police. Let's listen.
I regard as indefensible the fact that I did not report the accident to the police immediately. Instead of looking directly for a telephone after lying exhausted in the grass for an undetermined time, I walked back to the cottage where the party was being held and requested the help of two friends, my cousin Joseph Gargan and Paul Markham, and directed them to return immediately to the scene with me. This was sometime after midnight, in order to undertake a new effort to dive down and locate Miss Kopechne.
So let me see if I understand this. So after the accident, he walked the mile or so back to the party, got his cousin and someone else to return to the bridge. Then he swam across the water, concussion and all, to get to his hotel room. And then as he later said, the next morning, his first call was to a legal advisor. And only after that did he call the police. And I think to this day, I think that's the most damning thing about this tragedy, that he waited so long.
It just caused great puzzlement on every reporter and I think members of the public's mind as to what had happened here. And he had no proof to disprove it, so suspicions were allowed to go unabated. You know, we did try to put his assertions to the test on the ground, hard reporting. We did come up with an individual who had seen Deputy Sheriff, who had seen the car at a crossroads, and he got out of his car and was approaching Senator Kennedy's car, and the car took off. He said he doesn't know if Kennedy or Kennedy's car, people in Kennedy's car, him or the senator, Ms. Kopechne, recognized him, but it went off in the wrong direction. Did he panic? And because he was in a car with a single woman, did he have alcohol in his breath? The amounts of suspicions continue endlessly with this, without scientific proof to show what had happened one way or the other. But really, as far as why he didn't report it, and did he have to wait until he got the political advice to report it the next morning, that has only perpetuated the suspicions about his actions that night. And that still remains a mystery.
Now, you're talking about the Boston Globe revisiting this in 1974. Did you speak to Senator Kennedy at all about Chappaquiddick?
Thanks for asking that question. We did. Gerard O'Neill, who was the editor of the Globe Spotlight team at the time, and I had probably 3 or 4 hour interview with the senator in his Washington office, in which we asked him specific questions, detailed questions, to try to bring up the inconsistencies in his statements and others' statements about the party. What had happened, as he went, before he went over the bridge, what had happened after the accident, that this imponderable of waiting for, all these hours to report the accident. He answered the question, for the most part, though, referring to the transcript of his testimony that he had given at an earlier inquest. There had been an inquest, which is a closed-door legal questioning of all the people who were at the party and were investigated the case officially.
And that was January of 1970, correct?
Yeah, let me say 70 sounds right. I don't have the transcript, but he had his transcript of his back and forth, and he would refer to it. And at one point, I put my hand onto the transcript, and I said, Senator, we're trying to get as spontaneous answers as possible from you. And he said, as he should have, I'm trying to make sure that I cover your questions with as complete as information. By that time, it was 5 years after the accident. And he wanted to make sure that the answers that he had given in 1970, which was 1 year after the accident, what he was saying now, he sort of chafed at that he, in answering our questions, he would read from his transcript, and we asked for more spontaneous, and he did, and we got, I think we got some fresh comments from him that were important, two or three. I think it was a four-part series, and we led with that interview. We led the series with that interview, and not only did he call it indefensible, he called it inexcusable. At the end of the interview, I vividly recall this, and it was a long interview, and I would want to have to go through an interview with Gerry O'Neill. He's a really comprehensive, focused reporter. And at the end of the interview, the senator was answering the questions really with his head on his arm, laying his arm on his desk. And it really showed how difficult this whole thing was for him. He answered every question we had as fully as he was able to. And at the end, he wanted to, this was a Friday afternoon, now 6:30 at night, the Capitol building was closed. He wanted to escort us out of the Capitol, which he said, give me a second, I'm going into my bathroom. And he went to his his bathroom to freshen up, and he came out, and I was astonished as to how refreshed he looked. And I thought to myself, remember this moment, Stephen. This is a consummate professional. And he had all the command. He was as gracious as ever. He was gracious in showing us the office and answering all our questions. But now he looked at graciousness and said, this man will make a difference in, our political lives. And he did. Chappaquiddick did not define this man. It could have, but it did not. He followed in the legacy of his great brothers, Joe, John, and Robert, in public service. I have to say, I'm retired now, so I can say this. I voted for him every time that I was in Massachusetts and he ran for re-election. I just think he was an extraordinary senator.
Even 1 year after Chappaquiddick in 1970, when he faced the voters for the first time after the tragedy, he got an overwhelming re-election victory. So if you had one question to this day you still wanted answered about the incident, what would it be?
About the whole thing?
About the whole thing, yeah. Something that's just been unanswered, and if you could get the answer to one part of this whole tragedy, what would it be?
Well, I think the senator's answers have all been given. The one question I would ask would be of those, particularly Gargan and Markham, the men who are in the car with him, I would ask for them, what did you tell him to do as you drove from the accident scene to the then probably a couple of miles on Chappaquiddick, to the waterfront in Chappaquiddick, that he was then going to, then he dove into the channel and to swim across to Edgartown. What did you talk about during that drive back to the waterfront where the senator jumped into the water? Because it's that conversation that we would know for certain whether there was any conspiracy or any scheming, let me not say conspiracy because we don't know what was said, but any scheming that was talked about as far as of how this would be reported and when it would be reported.
Steve Kirkjian is a Pulitzer Prize-winning former reporter and editor for the Boston Globe. In 1969, as a Globe Cub reporter, he covered the incident at Chappaquiddick. Steve, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you very much, Ken. A pleasure, and good luck with your program.
Thank you so much. It was 48 years ago this week, on July 18th, 1969, when a car driven by Senator Ted Kennedy plunged over a bridge at Chappaquiddick Island off Martha's Vineyard. Kennedy swam to safety, but his passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, drowned. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.